The army doesn't like more than one disaster in a day.
Looks bad in the newspapers and upset civilians at their breakfast.
I'm Bill Buppert, retired army officer and a regular warfare practitioner and scholar. Welcome to Chasing Ghosts, an Irregular Warfare podcast, the show that examines the mythos, lost history, bad thinking, martial malpractice, and government incompetence that informs so much of irregular warfare. I want to peek behind the curtain at the vast machinery and briar patch politics of insurgency and counterinsurgency and everything in between. Now, let's go ghost hunting together. Hello and welcome to episode 65 of Chasing Ghosts in a Regular Warfare podcast. Episode 65, Color Revolutions Weaponizing Subterfuge, is our episode for this week. So first of all, of course, we need to get on the same sheet of music, as it were, on just what it is we're discussing. I think that if you've paid attention to the news in the last quarter century, you've probably seen the notion of color revolutions bandied about. It's very important contemporaneously because it was a color revolution in 2008 and 2014 that caused so many difficulties in Ukraine, which has become the cavalcade of calamities that led to the special military operation conducted by the Russians when they invaded the Ukraine, for a lot of things that if intelligence analysts and political analysts and conflict analysts had been paying attention and doing their due diligence research and just considering what was going on Earth at the time in Europe and greater Asia, they could have called the ball and found out what was causing all of those problems. A color revolution is a term used to describe a series of nonviolent or semi-violent popular uprisings, often driven by civil society, and these aim to overthrow a government or challenge its authority, typically in post-Soviet or authoritarian states, but you will find it in all manner of states, as the EUSSR out of Brussels has proven with what they've done with elections in Romania, which it was not the preferable outcome that Brussels wanted, which wants very authoritarian, left-of-center polities peppered throughout the continent that will do what Brussels wishes to do in its pursuit of emulating what used to be the Soviet Union and updating and remarketing the Soviet collectivist idea in the 21st century. So it is characterized by a number of things, and you'll find that that term emerged in the early 2000s. There's this cretin by the name of Norm Eisen in America who has been filing a number of lawfare lawsuits. I think the number is approaching 150 against administrations in the White House that he doesn't care for and has used lawfare as color revolution minus in the United States. There are also those observers of United States elections that would paint what happened in 2020 as a color revolution. So you've seen this term gain more and more traction. Key features of color revolutions are nonviolent resistance, even though I don't think that that is quite the marker that occurs, for instance, when you look at the behavior of BLM and Antifa in the United States, which one can look at as color revolution adjacent symbolism, use of colors, flowers, or other symbols to brand the movement. The very notion of color revolutions is such that Ukraine has an orange revolution, Georgia has a rose revolution. When you saw what was going on in the Arab world on the Arab street in the 20-teens, all of a sudden those were looked at as revolutions. In this case, color revolutions. You'll find that youth and NGO, non-governmental organizations, which, by the way, if they're non-governmental organizations, why do they take government money? But that's neither here nor there. Often led by young activists, student groups, and non-governmental organizations. You will see this in everything from Greta Thunberg to a variety of youth movements that have stymied political authority across Europe, for instance, in the last two decades. Election disputes are another thing that is capitalized and leveraged by color revolutions, where once one gets to electronic balloting and gets away from paper balloting and accountancy means that provide a number of fail safes and checks and balances on the counting. Remember, it was Joseph Stalin himself who said it isn't who votes that counts, but who counts the votes that counts. I'm paraphrasing. What is going to be the geopolitical context for these things? Notable examples that one can look at are Serbia in 2000 with the bulldozer revolution. You can look at Georgia with the Rose Resolution, as I mentioned, in 2003. That did not end well with the Russian incursions in 2008 later on. 2004, the Orange Revolution in the Ukraine, followed by the reconsolidation in 2008, and what I would classify as a Western-sponsored coup in 2014 to make sure that Ukraine, which has been the center of money laundering for the West ever since the fall of the Soviet Union, was very important for them to make sure that they could take advantage of that and lean it into steering to Western interest at all times. Kyrgyzstan in 2005 with the Tulip Revolution. These protests ousted President Askar Akayev after allegations of corruption and electoral rigging. I'm always amused by that with these notions of accusations of corruption, election rigging, those kind of things. You will find that if you forensically examine the first formations of the European Union, once paper balloting was eliminated for electronic balloting, all of a sudden, magically, electronic balloting started giving Brussels more and more consolidated power over its rump states within Europe, which I think increased from under 10 countries in the original EU. I was too lazy to look it up, into going on 31, 32, 33 countries as the NATO blob and the EU blob continues to extend eastward against the Soviet and Russian frontiers. I say Soviet because we have to keep in mind that everything that has happened is a matter of historical linkages between the cause and effect of nation states. So one cannot look at modern Russia without looking at the influence that Soviet politics and the Soviet experiment influenced in the way it behaves, much like you can't look at what happened in the Soviet Union without examining what happened the previous hundreds of years under the Tsarist administrations. Now, in the given literature, the experts, as they are, call this different from a coup. They say, unlike a traditional coup d'etat, by the way, coup d'etat is one of many variants of coups, it involves a small group, often military, seizing power swiftly. Color revolutions rely on mass mobilization and aim for broader political change, though they can be exploited by elites or external actors to resemble a soft coup. I've got to tell you that when it comes to this language variant between coups and color revolutions, I happen to think that they are synonyms. And in this case, this is, by its very nature and definitional construct, a coup. It may not be a coup d'etat, but it could be a coup. Let's examine the various taxonomies of coups very quickly so that we can instantiate that. Now, I remember reading a 1968-1969 book by Edward Luttwak, who I really enjoy reading. He's written on the strategy and grand strategy of the Roman Empire, the Soviet Union, and other such books. I really like his rather curmudgeonly and deeply thought out ways of interpreting historical events, how they matter, the way we view what's going on right here, right now, and what those implications are for the future. We'll talk about that in a bit. But first of all, I wanted to go over the various kinds of coups. A military coup, as we had just mentioned earlier, as the armed forces overthrew the government, often using force or intimidation. And by the way, as those of you who listen to me in my other episodes know that I draw a distinction between those various coups when it comes to regional conflict complexes. What that basically means is that every larger war blows oxygen on the embers of long dead or dormant conflicts and causes those that oxygen to allow those things to start to come to the fore again so that those conflicts emerge out of the dark and could become hot at any time. It is, of course, in all things war and conflict, one of the unintended consequences of starting wars in the first place, as evidenced by World War II, for instance, which allegedly ended in 1945 and made the world safe for Soviet communism. And there were a wide variety of neo-colonial, post-colonial conflicts that emerged because as a result of the larger war, it had breathed oxygen into the dormant embers of all of these colonial conflicts in Africa, for instance, and breathed new life into them. And then you saw the massive shedding of colonial holdings by European powers, for instance, over the next four decades. Thailand's 2014 coup, where the military ousted Prime Minister Ying Lakshidawatra, is an example of this. A palace coup, insiders within the ruling elite, ministers, royal family, replaced the leader without altering the system. Qatar's 1995 coup, where Sheikh Hamad bin Khalifa Al Thani overthrew his father, much like what you would see happening elsewhere. A civilian coup, non-military actors such as political elites, technocrats or oligarchs seize power, often exploiting legal or institutional mechanisms. The 2002 Venezuelan coup attempt against Hugo Chavez, backed by civilian elites and media, would be an example of this. I would also suggest to you that the EU in Brussels has conducted something very much like this. A self-coup, which is called an autogolpe. A leader in power orchestrates a coup to consolidate control, often by suspending democratic institutions. Venezuela's 2017 move by Nicolas Maduro to create a constituent assembly, sidelining the opposition-led parliament, was an example of this. Many of these examples abound. A soft coup, nonviolent, often covert efforts to oust a government through political, economic, or judicial pressure. By the way, that term covert could be clandestine. Clandestine would be black to black. Covert is where it is a cover operation in which folks are saying they are one thing when they are actually another. An electoral coup, manipulation of elections to seize or retain power, using fraud, voter suppression, or institutional rigging. One can look at the 1984-1986 Philippine elections. One can look at what's happened in Israel, for instance, by the overt manipulation regime imposed by the Obama administration when it came to Israeli elections and such. None of this is unusual. And if you look at the coup, for instance, in 1953, where a Western-friendly Shah was put in place, you will find the hallmarks and fingerprints and receipts of three-letter agencies in the West that have been using regime change through these kind of not necessarily military revolutions, but color revolutions to do that very thing. Now, Belarus's 2020 election, where Alexander Lukashenko's disputed victory led to protest, he still maintained his group. But then again, if we look on the West, and mind you, when we have this in our minds that only evil actors will do these things, it depends on your perspective on evil. But as I mentioned a bit earlier, when it came to Romania and it came to Italy and some other elections that have occurred on the European continent since 2020, there is a lot of stuff that doesn't smell right when it comes to the manipulation of elections in countries across the board there under Brussels' boot. This is my show, so I can have my opinions. And as you've probably detected, I do not have a high opinion at all of Brussels and the European Union. And I think that for a lot of reasons, it is probably one of the world's most warmongering regimes and seems hell-bent on creating a European Union Soviet Socialist Republic, in my opinion. Having just visited Croatia last year with my bride, we discovered anecdotally that people there, for the most part, loathe the EU, they loathe NATO, they loathe the taxation and regulation regimes. They loathe the imposition of immigration policies on them. As a matter of fact, what you find again and again is that the Eastern European countries, having lived under the Soviet boot and lived on that collectivist plantation for so long, are probably much more skeptical of what the EU is up to when they see the end state. You're seeing murmurings, especially in Poland, which may become a very large player on the European continent militarily, that they continue to possess a very healthy skepticism of what the EU is up to. I happen to think that both the United States and the European Union conduct color revolutions all the time to manipulate and expand their power over other countries. Now, mind you, these are mass, often nonviolent, popular uprisings. Popular, I put that in air quotes, aimed at overthrowing a government, typically in response to electoral fraud or authoritarianism. At least that is the excuse made, using symbolic colors or imagery. Driven by civil society, youth, and NGOs, as I just mentioned. Ukraine's 2014 Euromaidan protest, which ousted President Viktor Yanukovych, who I wouldn't say that he was cozying up to Russia, but since Russia is the neighbor, was trying to make sure that since William Burns and his 2008 Department of State cable as ambassador to Russia at the time said that NATO membership of the Ukraine is a red line for the Russians. And if it is offered and if their neutrality is not respected, Russia will do something about it. And of course, history tells us that that is precisely what happened. What you'll find, as with all things, and you can read Machiavelli's The Prince, which is probably, I would say, one of the first formal coup manuals in the modern era. What you see again and again is that these manipulations do not measure the second and third order effects of harm imposed on both those populations and maybe contiguous and non-contiguous neighbors and allies, and how terrible that becomes. Often, well, let's not say often, sometimes leading to open warfare, which is always suboptimal for any country. So you can see why probably among the professoriate in the Department of State, they make a very clear demarcation between color revolutions and coups, but I don't make that distinction because I think that they are one and the same. They're simply different instantiations and operational models on how to achieve the end result. Hybrid coups, for instance, it's a combination of coup types, blending military, civilian, or external elements to achieve said regime change. It could involve military backing or may not. You can find, for instance, what happened with the Taliban in the 1990s, and then what happened with the Taliban after the departure of the United States could meet some of those definitional constructs. In the 2019 Sudanese coup, where military leaders ousted Omar al-Bashir and mass civilian protests resulted after that. Well, that's another kind. Syria recently, where al-Qaeda, which has been a U.S. and Western government-sponsored entity on and off since the 1980s, finally found themselves an actual head of state after their failed attempts in ISIS in the country of Syria after sending the Assads packing. So the professoriates and the universities who pay attention to this kind of thing and get in their endless scholastic circle jerks to take determinations on what is the bifurcation between coups versus color revolutions. Traditional coups are top-down, elite-driven, and often swift, while color revolutions are bottom-up, mass-based, and prolonged. This is the observation they make, but it is patently false because you will find that all of these color revolutions, without exception, tend to be driven by the elites in power or maybe out of power at the time, who from a top-down perspective, especially using status surveillance mechanisms and intelligence agencies, police powers, military powers, whatever may be the case, you will find again and again that the distinction between coup and color revolution is a very thin line indeed, and the success varies with these. Military coups often install juntas. Palace coups maintain elites, and color revolutions may lead to democracy or instability. Now, when I say democracy or instability, I'm sort of emulating the line that is given by the conventional university mandarins who say that kind of thing. Because when you think about it historically, democracies are inherently unstable for a variety of reasons. Democracies are not immune from waging war. Democracies are not immune from waging war against their citizens domestically. Everything an empire in America is certainly an empire. Everything an empire does abroad, it all comes home, as all of us know, even from anecdotal experience in America, that this is not quite the free and liberty obsessed America that we have had in the past for a variety of reasons. External actors, such as the U.S., Russia, and China, often influence these coups or color revolutions. I would tell you the vast majority of color revolutions, for instance, we can look at Ukraine as that battle between the Russians and the West as a very good example of how that very thing occurs, where you have a variety of external actors who are doing these things. Now, one thing that I'd like to introduce my audience to, in case you're not aware, is that there's something called the Culpus data set. And what that Culpus data set is a means by which David B. Carter and Joseph G. Wright compiled from 1946 to 2022, including microstates, a master coup list. And it's in Excel and Stata. And it is quite interesting to look at the sheer breadth, depth, and number of what one can characterize as both coups slash color revolutions that have occurred that are extraordinary to the agency themselves of those individual governments. It's a review of prior data sets, historical documents, and secondary literature, and it also provides data on the identity of coup leaders and codes, whether the coup leaders sought or achieved regime change, which is called coups de regime, or leader reshuffling, which is coup de chef. Leader reshuffling, a good example of that, would be the last 15 years of the Soviet Union and the various corpses they put on broomsticks and propped up as leaders of the respective Politburo until the entire country imploded in 1989 to 1991. I will put this in the show notes for you to review at your leisure. There are hours, if not days, of pleasure reading in this if you wish. I also found another data set by Jonathan M. Powell and Clayton L. Tyne, Global Instances of Coups from 1950 to 2010, a new data set. Now, what I particularly liked about that one was when you examine Table 1 in the coverage and definitions of coups in previous research, they provide a wide variety of, let's say, different kinds of coup taxonomies and what those were. For instance, under perpetrator, it goes from everything from undefined, including revolutions, to organized factions, to segment of the state apparatus, to civil or military, to regular armed forces as opposed to not so regular armed forces. I also wanted to quote from the conclusion for the data set that I just talked about, quote, coups should also be of interest to those studying democracy. Coups are likely to derail the process of democratization and or democratic consolidation, as they seem to have recently in Thailand and Mauritania. They might have the opposite effect by removing long-standing authoritarian leaders from power. Recent rumblings by the military in Zimbabwe, for example, suggest that President Mugabe's long-awaited exit is likely the result of a coup. Remember, this is 2010, 2011. Each of these possibilities is immediately relevant to policymakers, particularly given the well-documented efforts to foment coups in foreign states in the past. U.S. efforts against Chavez in Venezuela in 2002 and Hussein in Iraq in 1991, for example, were based on the view that coups were the most peaceful and direct ways to bring about positive regime change. Policymakers would likely be similarly interested in knowing which of their favored leaders have a high likelihood of being overthrown in a coup, which could be forecasted with our data. We hope that the data set previewed in this article will provide the tools necessary to tackle such interesting research questions. And you will notice something interesting in this conclusion. That's end of quote. That's this. In there, they're actually saying, the authors are actually saying that well-documented efforts to foment coups in foreign states in the past, they may be the most peaceful and direct way to bring about positive regime change. In other words, other countries, in this case, mostly first world nations, looking at developing countries and third world nations, taken under their own advisement and counsel, that it would be meritorious for their national security, whether it is neutral or advantageous to it, to conduct these kind of things. And as all of us know, in our personal lives, our professional lives, things that we've read in history, I am well versed in military history and some others, is that the second, third order effects, the unintended consequences. What I love to say is Newton's third law is a stone cold motherfracker. And what's going to occur as a result of you throwing into a mix in which your cultural IQ may be wanting, you may not like the results of what happens after that. If one looks at recent history after World War II, you find that the Shah of Iran led to that 1953 coup, led directly to the 1979 overthrow of the regime in Iran that was friendly to the United States. In the 1980s, Saddam Hussein and Manuel Noriega in Panama would arguably be classified as federal employees, very friendly to what the United States wanted, and all of a sudden, everything changes, and it doesn't work out the way the U.S. architects thought that it would. I would suggest to you that, and I will leave in the show notes, a great history of the CIA that I highly recommend, that when you look at so many of the things that that agency and other extended agencies have done since 1947 to 1948, not only has it been injurious to America and injurious especially to Imperial America because of unintended consequences, but you'll find that again and again, it tends to have such terrific blowback. One could arguably say that 9/11 was a result of not only what America did in the Middle East, but as I've told you before in previous episodes, you can thank Churchill for most of the ills of the Middle East with his fascination in gentlemen's club napkins of very sharp arithmetic right angles, regardless of clan, blood, and family feuds that may have occurred in the very countries that he's trying to stake out as these individual modern, in that case, 20th century nation states. And all of us know that didn't work out well at all. I had mentioned Edward Luttwak's book, Coup d'etat, Practical Handbook, which was published in 1968. There is a revised second edition that came out in the 20-teens. I highly recommend that because the introduction to the second edition is an excuse for the author to brag about all the bloodstained and bullet-riddled copies of the first edition that have been found among the personal effects of palace security chiefs, spy masters, and Air Force officers. Perhaps he gloats they should have read it more carefully, or perhaps they should have waited for the second edition. So I won't trouble you with the details of the first book published in 1968 and then the second revised edition and how interesting it is. But he goes through things like operational sequence and timing, the perimeters of early warning systems, and a lot of very interesting graphs in there to include how to establish roadblocks around palaces during said coups and things like that. So recommended. Charles Haywood at the Worthy House, wrote a very good review of coup d'etat in 2018. Quote, so how does Lutwak advise seizing power? The basic pedagogic method of this book is to divide the topic into core categories, definition, feasibility, plan, and execution, and within those, provide rules that flow from logic and from a range of historical examples Lutwak provides. As far as definitions, he defines a coup as a special form of politics that requires guns as an aid to persuasion, although coups rarely succeed if guns are much used and fail totally if the situation degenerates into civil war. A coup is swift and a complete seizure of the mechanism of state power. He knows that what makes a coup possible is a modern separation of much of the mechanism of governance from the political rulers themselves, allowing control of the former to be peeled away from the latter, which also means that a state such as Saudi Arabia, cross-linked throughout by traditional bonds, is hard to execute a coup against. In short, a successful coup uses parts of the state apparatus to seize the controlling levers over the rest. Notably, a coup is not a revolution. It seeks to control the current system, not destroy it. The masses are not directly involved, and it has no necessary bias toward being executed more by either left or right. This is all about power, although it may have an ideological overlay. End of quote. And might I say that for those of you who may be partisan as far as what is conventionally referred to as left or right, may find that your analysis is much sharper when you divorce yourselves in a dispassionate fashion from that allegiance, so that you are not swayed unconsciously by an evidentiary bias that is going to say, well, that is poking the bear of my left wing or right-wing ideological treasures and bugbears that I hold so closely to myself. As Peter Boghossian tells us, side bias, that alliance with whatever your philosophical or moral framework is the most powerful bias to try to overwhelm with further evidence. And also, that when it comes to Lutwak's definitions of coups, in 1968, he emphasized guns. In his 2016 edition, which was improved, he continued to think that maybe that had something that was important to add, but not necessarily, because the guns of power, as Machiavelli would have told us hundreds of years ago, aren't necessarily those guns that one can use to vanquish your enemies, but the guns that are in the levers of power, whether that be at the ballot box or the deep state or the bureaucratic state. Now, we could go on for hours pursuing this just with Lutwak's book, which I really enjoy. Here's another excerpt. Quote, next, Lutwak covers planning, here focusing on the 1961 Algerian-French coup attempt, which de Gaulle successfully defeated, and also on a successful attempt, one of many in Syria in 1961. Lutwak's main point is that mere control of the military is inadequate. Some thought must be given to planning to control, neutralize, or defeat political opposition during and immediately after the coup, especially with the role that social media plays today. Again, Lutwak wrote before the 2016 Turkish coup attempt, but social media played a critical role in defeating that attempt. Here, Lutwak focuses heavily on personalities, by which he means charismatic leaders who must be neutralized, i.e. kidnapped or killed at the very beginning of the coup, although he only refers obliquely to that second option. He also discusses geography of control, the blocking of roads, and so forth, end of quote. You have to remember that what Lutwak had put together in 1968 was sort of like a handbook, a roadmap on how to conduct a coup. It was an academic exercise for him that I'm certain, being the rascal that he is, he found quite amusing to do that very thing. So he goes on, quote, this is all incisively and well-written. I suspect it not quite updated enough from 68. For example, I think that while it mentions social media, it does not emphasize its role enough, nor how best to neutralize its effect. Whether you're the state trying to prevent a coup or plotters trying after the coup begins to neutralize political opposition that may slow down your coup or prevent coordination of civilians against your actions. How does one kill Twitter or Facebook in a country other than by wholly shutting the internet down? Because it is quite easy to evade filters and blocks if you are motivated enough. This question is a bit more complex than it seems, though, because it assumes that Facebook, Twitter, and the other GAFA companies are opposed to tyranny and will allow themselves to be used to combat tyranny or at a minimum remain neutral in the conflict. This is false. Their decision dynamic is totally different. It boils down to A, in large markets, actively cooperating with tyranny, and in small markets, assist leftists in power and harm any right activity, whether in power or not. End of quote. What Charles is referring to here in reviewing the book is that there is this phenomenon in which we can make the innocent and naive assumption that the powers that be and their attached corporate entities will always want to err on the side of individual liberty and freedom. And we know that that is absolutely not the case. The twin struggles of both the COVIDiocy nightmare in 2020 through 2024, and then, of course, the election that had a lot of questionable outcomes in 2020 that future historians, maybe decades from now, will be able to parse apart with evidence and discover with a better finality and conjecture exactly what happened in that curious event that we call the 2020 U.S. elections that has a lot of questions remaining. I am not an election denier, but I am certainly an election skeptic who calls into question a lot of the very non-statistical errata that occurred at that time that were so much out of step with history prior to that in the electoral processes of the United States. Charles goes on, it is tempting to try to map Ludwig's analysis into the present day. Remember, this is 2018. On the left, we hear that Trump is leading a coup against America, though what the means is to do that is pretty unclear. On the right, we hear that the deep state is attempting to overthrow Trump. Leaving aside the truth of either claim, neither of these is much like the types of coups that Ludwig analyzes. I think it is true that the deep state, basically consisting of pushers of global neoliberal hegemony combined with pushers of vicious left-wing social politics, wants Trump gone. But just because Trump let his opponents create in the Mephistophelian person of Robert Mueller a witch-hunting task force of unlimited power devoted to the single goal of destroying him doesn't mean that even if they succeed, there has been a coup. After all, Trump doesn't even control most of the levers of government now. His opponents do. Remember, this is 2018. They are just trying to keep it that way. End of quote. There's a lot to unpack there. But if you draw anything, if you draw a single thing from listening to this episode, it is this. Coups and color revolutions are synonyms. And that when we examine the means by which empires influence extramilitarily the fates of other nations, all of that can come home. And I think that that would be one of the most important cautionary tales here, is that color revolutions are here to stay. And what they've in essence done is they've taken the best of Machiavelli's The Prince and Machiavellian principles, as it were. We have fast-forwarded into the late 20th century and the early 21st century, and by commanding the heights of electronic media, social media, elections manipulation, television programming, journalistic ethics, and all of these other components that are the whoop and wharf of culture in the West, these are able to be manipulated in a fashion, both vanilla and dark, in a way that ensures that those in power can stay in power. That is the very essence of what these things are about, especially, as I said a little earlier in this episode, the palace coup is all about maintaining the status quo as it is, but ensuring that there's a different personage at the helm than the one that they have just dethroned. So in research for this episode, I read a book called Color Revolutions, Techniques in Breaking Down Modern Political Regimes by Oleg Karpovich and Andrei Manoilo. Very interesting. I wanted to read some excerpts from this. Quote, it is interesting that in the latest works of Western authors, including British and French, There appear assessments of the color revolutions, which are contrary to the notions of color revolutions, as instruments of democratization and formation of a democratic world as imposed by the United States. For example, some scientists are beginning, still quite cautiously, to argue that none of the color revolutions in the Middle East and North Africa have brought prosperity to the Christian world. On the contrary, the Arab Spring has stirred up the most dangerous extremist forces representing Islamism and forced them to withdraw from the deep underground, which the Western countries have yet to deal with at the official level. The Arab Spring that began under the banner of democratization of the Arab East accelerated the retreat of Christianity under the pressure of radical Islam, which strengthened with the beginning of the color revolutions of the Arab Spring. The Arab Spring, created with the money and with the help of American and Western European allies, has become a Western Christian civilization that is already experiencing an acute crisis, the beginning of the Christian winter. Western Christianity has put down another line of defense. It makes us seriously think about what role today the color revolutions actually play in world politics in the formation of a new world order, and what will become if the wave of the color revolutions will not be stopped in time. And of course, we see what's happened in the Syrian vector, where we have an Al-Qaeda member in charge of a major country that has traditionally been aligned in the Shia crescent. There's a gentleman by the name of Yuri Bezmenov. He was a Soviet journalist for the Novosti Press Agency. In 1970, as a member of the Soviet mission in New Delhi, India, Bezmenov defected to the West and was resettled in Canada pursuant to an arrangement between American and Canadian security agencies. He's best remembered for his anti-Marxist, anti-Soviet, anti-atheist lectures and books published in the 1980s. And he's the one who brought to our attention in the West the kind of desinformatia, maskarovka, and espionage efforts by the Russians that entire time. Because the Russians, I think even they knew to a certain extent that their military power was limited as a global hegemon, certainly not limited as a regional hegemon, as they proved again and again, like in 1956 and 1958 with the coups that were attempted then that were put down in a brutal fashion. In 1984, he gave an interview to G. Edward Griffin, which I recommend you take a look at if you get the opportunity, titled Soviet Subversion of the Free World Press. In the interview, Bezmenov stated that the KGB wanted the political system of the U.S. to gradually be subverted and explained methods that they were supposedly using. Quote, "The main emphasis of the KGB is not in the area of intelligence at all. Only about 15% of time, money, and manpower is spent on espionage and such. The other 85% is a slow process, which we call either ideological subversion or active measures or psychological warfare." Highly recommend you take a listen to that interview if you get the opportunity, but here are some of the highlights. In part, Bezmenov described this process as a great brainwashing that has four basic stages. The first stage is called demoralization, which takes from 15 to 20 years to achieve. According to the former KGB agent, that is the minimum number of years it takes to re-educate one generation of students that is normally exposed to the ideology of its country. In other words, the time it takes to change what the people are thinking. By the way, that demoralization process is irreversible. And even Bezmenov thought back in 1984 that the process of demoralizing America was already completed by 1984. Once that is achieved, the second stage of ideological brainwashing is destabilization. During this 2 to 5 year period, asserted Bezmenov, what matters is the targeting of essential structural elements of a nation, the economy, foreign relations, defense systems. The third stage would be crisis. It would take only up to 6 weeks to send a country into crisis. The crisis will bring a violent change of power, structure, and economy. And will be followed by the last stage, which is normalization. That's when your country is basically taking over, living under a new ideology and reality. Now, mind you, I would suggest that all of these things have occurred in the U.S. and West that we live in already, and that to a large extent, when you look at the woke phenomenon, The woke phenomenon is basically that final stage. It is the normalization of what would have once been considered completely off the field of endeavor of normal human beings and accepted as the normal reality. As a matter of fact, nay, the aspiration of all moral human beings to achieve that very thing. So I think that whether you think that Bezmenov came over here to reveal things because he was a defector or came over here maybe as a very clever triple agent, whereby the KGB thought that he could accelerate this demolition of the U.S. and the West by articulating these principles, and maybe even in a sly fashion, those who wish to make these changes, whether it's the university professoriate, which has steered ever more in a government supremacist direction for decades, if not generations, that all of a sudden we do have at the turn of the 21st century, the morphing of the previously, quote, politically correct mindset into this hybridized, accelerated, and monolithic woke mindset, which has so much commonality with communism and socialism. I saw a joke the other day that was quite amusing, where they said that for those of you who find yourself on either side of the climate alarmism paradox, why doesn't China concern itself with global warming? Well, the answer is because they already have a communist government. And keep in mind Buper's three rules of woke club. The first rule of woke club: you have zero accountability for any personal failure or rake stomping you do. Second rule of woke club: whatever skin suit you wear, your core being is victimhood. And third rule of woke club: everyone must worship your mental illness. I think that pretty much sums it up. You can plug and play as you wish. But the point that I'm trying to make is that when it comes to coups, color revolutions, and such, there must be cultural changes that have to instantiate and evidence themselves in society in a broad consensus, whether consciously or unconsciously, of people grokking and accepting that that new framework of understanding is the consensus and that anything out of it is unacceptable. Here's what you have to know in the year of our Lord 2025, when this podcast episode is being published. When it comes to coups, when it comes to color revolutions, when it comes to all of these things, those that will themselves and wish to have power over you are going to do so. They are going to use any means possible. In that, if you thought that the election processes, for instance, were sacrosanct and subject to many checks and balances so that the garbage that went in is the actual garbage that came out, to use the tortured computer speak for data provenance, well, that's not quite the case anymore. We see time after time, whether it was the 2020 election in the United States or the elections that have occurred on the continent in the EU, where the election results apparently weren't quite what the Brussels EUSSR mandarins wanted, and they went back to the ballot box and said, well, we need to try that again. These kind of things are all part of the same weave. They're all same of the part of the same tapestry of what this kind of manipulation entails in order to achieve the power that is wished. Whether it's the money laundering functionalities of places like the Ukraine, the institutionalized corruption that we find throughout the West, or all the various causes belli that are employed to get a country or a coalition of countries to go to war against another country, all of these are tools in the tool chest. All of these are various manipulation modalities that are going to be employed. So coups, and in their more subtle and politically correct manifestations of color revolutions, are with us for eternity, whether we like it or not. And the entire, as you will find when you examine the Culpus data set, the entire corpus of U.S. and Western-sponsored color revolutions One can arguably say, let's confine ourselves to the end of World War II and beyond, because one can easily say that 1953 certainly had the stink of a color revolution in Iran, that one has to find ways to protect yourself against these as a country, a state, a province, an individual, whatever the case may be. I leave you with this. Once you grok and you're comfortable with not assuming that everything the shining city on the hill, Washington, D.C., and the United States, and its concomitant satraps throughout the West, to include the Pacific, have been doing all of these things in a selfless and altruistic manner to achieve the best and brightest for all of mankind, well, the conclusions are a bit more cynical than that. So I would urge you to take what I've discussed with you over the past 50 minutes, park it in your headspace and grok it, think about it. And if you have any feedback, recommendations, comments, or such, in gentlemanly comportment, of course, to communicate to me, you can get in touch with me at cgpodcast@pm.me. That is cgpodcast@pm.me. You can visit my Substack. Both of these things will be in the show notes, along with my book recommendations and article breadcrumbs that I've left for you. Again, I want to thank my listeners for your solicitude and listening to the end. If you like this, please leave a review or stars at the podcasting venue you happen to be listening to this on. If you think that you have friends, family, neighbors, or business associates who may be interested in what we go on about here in my podcast series, both Chasing Ghosts and my treatment of conventional warfare and conflict futurism in War Notes, a conflict podcast, please be sure to do so. So I thank you for listening, and this is Bill out.